Welcome, everyone, for our first of a brand new series. I'm very excited to be part of this series on Megillat Ruth, Megillas Ruth, the book, very beautiful book of Ruth. We need to spend a few minutes before we begin to try to understand the significance of this Megillah. So just to set a little bit of context for ourselves, we know that there are five Megillot, the most famous, of course, is the book of Esther, Megillat Esther that we read on Purim. Rut is traditionally read on Shavuos, Zman Matan Torah Senu, the time of the giving of our Torah at Sinai. Therefore, it behooves us to try to take a few moments to understand the connection between Ruth and the Sinaitic covenant. Why is this so special? And if it's read on Shavuot, it's got to be very choshev. It's got to be a very important book. So first of all, we need to understand that we talk about Matan Torah, the giving of the law. What about Kabbalat HaTorah? What about the acceptance of the Torah law? That we don't know a whole lot about. So it could be that Ruth is going to open our eyes as anyone who sees things from outside looking in can see what someone born into something cannot see because they're already within. So Ruth was not, of course, born a Jew. Not only was she not born a Jew, but she came from the most distant, maligned segment, shall we say, of outside Judaism possible, the Moabite nation. Why do I say this? Because we know that the Moabites are the antithesis of the Jewish people. They are the opposite of the covenant of Abraham. How do we know this? Because Abraham and Sarah were defined by their chesed, by their kindness, their giving nature. And we know that the Moabites and the Ammonites, on the journey that the Jewish people took into the promised land, into Israel, were not even offered food, sustenance, even when they were willing to pay top dollar for it. The Moabites and Ammonites are the anti-chesed, the opposite of kindness. And therefore, God proclaims in the Torah, in the Bible itself, Amoni o Moavi, lo yavo bikal Hashem, that even 10 generations removed from a Moabite or Ammonite becoming Jewish, they are not allowed to marry a Jewess or a Jew. Ostensibly, we'll discuss this much more in depth. Meaning that they can marry each other, yes, but a Jewish man or woman, ostensibly, shouldn't be able to marry a member of this malign people, the Moabites and the Ammonites. And one of the reasons given is because we said they're like the anti-Abraham, anti-Sarah. They just cannot be part of the Jewish people. They have somehow defective genetics, their DNA is lacking, therefore we don't want that DNA mixing with our DNA and somehow causing problems for us. Okay. Now that said, Ruth clearly, if you know a little bit of the background of this amazing story, marries not only a Jewish person, but the Jew, the greatest leader of his generation, Boaz. So that's already something that you may know about. You may have a little inside information on the book, so we're going to have to address that because that's a huge issue. How could the rabbi, the judge of the people, transgress ostensibly a biblical law? I mean, it's right there. It's not like a rabbinical decree that was made up somewhere and people, it's the rabbis. No, this is God. So how did he get permission to do this? Major part of our story tonight. But Ruth is a remarkable heroine. Ruth was able to overcome the DNA, the genetics of her legacy, of her family, and we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight, and became such an integral part of the Jewish people that she became Ima Shamachut, the mother of all kings of Israel. That means David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, King David, King Solomon, et al., all the greatest kings are from, and Mashiach ben David, the Davidic line, Messiah, all from Ruth, this amazing woman. So it's amazing. So that's obviously a little bit of a hint that this is an important book to understand Ruth. But what's also equally critical is the connection to Shavuot, to our Torah, is simply a preamble that if you want to understand what it means to accept Torah, you need to understand what defines us as Jews. And as we said at the outset, if we're born into something, it's given to us, it's granted. So you take it for granted. That's who you are. But when you are not born into something and choose it, that's why a ger tzedek, a righteous Gentile, is on a higher plane, potentially, than a born Jew, because they weren't born into it. It wasn't gifted to them. They had to make a very difficult choice. And then on that journey to discovery and to self-realization of that choice is a magical journey, no more so than Ruth, as we're going to see. So give a little context to this story. When did the book of Ruth take place, chronologically, in real time, shall we say, as they would say by the great friend Jack Bauer, my friend? None of you know 24, but it was a famous show. Okay, good guy. You'd want him on your side in a war, that's for sure. So in real time, when did this take place? And secondly, who authored the book and for what purpose? So let's address the first question first. Okay, the rabbis have a whole lot to say about the chronology of the book of Ruth. And as, you know, rabbis are sometimes famous for, they don't always agree. So we have a three-way disagreement in the Talmud about when the chronology to place this story, because the author made no attempt at all, as we're going to see from the very first opening gambit, the very first pasuk, he made no attempt to try to place it historically. As we'll see, it's almost silly. He went to such extremes to not have it in chronological order, mesudar. So let's look at this chronological table of the book of really Judges. Starts with chronological events. So you have Yehoshua ben Nun, Joshua, the great student of Moses, who takes over leadership after the death of Moses. So this is when they cross over the Jordan, the Yarden, they come into Israel. So you have the book of Joshua, okay? Israelites enter Israel, Canaan, as it was called back then, 7 years conquest, 7 years apportionment, the sabbatical, Shemitah cycle begins, then we have some of the very famous judges, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Devorah, Deborah, Barak. Then it goes all the way down to Samson, second from the bottom, the Samson, yes, the one who, you know, took up the columns and brought the whole place down on the Philistines. And then we get to Eli. And Eli was a transitional character of tremendous proportion. Eli HaKohen, for anyone who has perhaps learned the book of Samuel, you'll recognize him. He's right at the beginning of the book as an aged judge, prophet, and priest. He had all of it, the whole trifecta, as they would say, at Belmont. He was everything. And Eli, unfortunately, was not able to pass it on to his children. Chafi and Pinchas were not great. But Eli was famous for misjudging the lovely, gracious Hannah, when she came to daven to pray for a child. That child ends up being Samuel Shmuel HaNavi, right? Now, why is this critical? Because Samuel is the author of the book of Ruth. He's also the author of the book of Judges, Shoftim. And he's also the author of his own book, Samuel, although he didn't live to finish it. But, again, you have Samuel authoring Judges, Ruth, and then the book of Samuel. And it's a huge transformative and transitional time for the Jewish people, because the book of Judges ends with the following declaration, that everyone in Israel kind of did their own thing. They just did whatever was correct in their eyes. They didn't listen to the judge unless they thought the judge was of a sterling character. But if they felt somehow the judge wasn't their cup of tea, they ignored the judge. And they needed, there was no leadership. Everyone was just kind of into their own Jewish anarchy, if you will. So there was a desperate need for leadership from the top. So Eli is the one who is both the last of the prophets, so to speak, and he is the last of that era. He's the last of those elders, and he's also the last of that generation of the judges who makes the transition, because after Eli, Samuel is like the first of the greatest of the Nevi'im, of the what we call the actual Nevi'im, okay? So you go from the elders to the Nevi'im, to the prophets themselves. And Samuel is the one who, of course, anoints King Saul first, and then subsequently King David. Clearly, if there is a void, a vacuum of leadership, because the judges are being ignored and there's no one to take the initiative, then that shall we say, transformative time where we went from the period of the judges as leaders to the actual Malachim, the kings of Israel, is an enormous time. Samuel is the character who made it all possible, because he's there to both record judges and the civil war that happened at the end called Pelegish Megiddo, which is another story for another day. That civil war almost destroyed the 12 tribes of Israel when Benjamin and the rest of the families of Israel went to war over a horrific incident called Pelegish Megiddo, Concubine and Giva. And from that point, you need leadership. So Samuel authors the book of Judges. He authors the book of Samuel. But where does Ruth fit in? Ah, I'm glad you asked. You see, Ruth doesn't have a time frame. And there's a lot of debate exactly when it took place. But according to Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who we call Rashi, he cites the following. He says that the lead hero in our story, Ruth is the lead heroine, but the lead hero is Boaz, as we mentioned before. But Boaz is not his real name. He's referred to as Ivtsan in the book of Judges. And he's a minor judge. Not a critical issue. In fact, there's three verses about his life. Three little verses. Okay? So he's not exactly a big character. But once we know that Boaz and Ivtsan are one and the same, the book of Ruth comes along and really fleshes out his entire, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. But what is critical about the book of Ruth is the following. Why was it not included then in the book of Judges? In other words, why limit, if you're Samuel, Shmuel HaNavi, why limit Boaz / Ivtsan to three verses? Why not just sort of flesh out the book of Judges, make it a little longer? We could do that. That's okay. He has license from God. And then you don't need the book of Ruth. What was the, so the book of Ruth is clearly a response. A response to something. It's a response to a necessity to validate the lineage of King David. Now why, you might ask. Let's get back to our original discussion. We talked about this malign nation, the Moabites. If David comes from a Moabite marriage, that's a big problem. Because not only do we have to ask the question which was asked by the infamous Doeg the Edomite, when Saul asked about, King Saul's already a little worried, a little paranoid, and he's worried about this young, handsome kid who plays a mean harp, a mean guitar, and he's handsome, and he writes beautiful prayers, and he's brilliant in learning, he has everything going on for him. And Saul's already a little jealous, so he says, you know, find out about the kid. I know he's from Judah, but find out which part of Judah he's from, if he's fit for Malchut, for the kingship or not. Should I worry about him? Is he a contender or not, right? Go find out. So Doeg replies to Saul, you know, before you ask whether he could be the king of Israel, why don't you ask whether he's actually Jewish by law? They're like, what? Because Doeg's referring to the fact that Boaz marries Ruth. And if Ruth is from Moab, gee, there's a verse in the Torah that says, no Moab person may enter the covenant of the Jewish people. So then that contaminates the genealogy of David to the point where not only can he not be the next king of Israel, he cannot even be Jewish by halachic standards, by Jewish law. So this is a huge thing. So Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel, clearly writes this book, among other things, to validate King David. And we know this because the very ending of the book reiterates Boaz, Ruth, and it takes you all the way down to the generations, and then David is the last person it mentions, King David. So it's clearly there. That's one part of the book. A second part of the book, as we said before, it's to explain us, for us to understand as born Jews what it means to choose Judaism. So that brings us all the way back to who? To Abraham and Sarah, who were the first to choose Judaism. So it's very profound that when you're at Sinai and you're thinking about big, lofty goals of Torah, Sinai, Revelation, we need to understand what does it mean to accept God? I mean, we're so used to it because from the time we're, you know, with our pacifiers, it's just who we are. We're brought up that way. This is what we are. But what if it wasn't that way? What if, you know, instead of going to shul, you went to the local Baal temple and they said, well, this is normal, right? You know, it's a different life, a different world. Living in Moab was a totally different paradigm for Ruth and for her ilk. So for Ruth to come from that paradigm, to come back, shall we say, the first, because remember, where did Moab come from? It came from Abraham's family because it was Lot, his greatest student, other than Eliezer, his slave. It was Lot, his own nephew, who betrayed Abraham when they had too much wealth, went to live in Sodom and Gomorrah, was rescued there, still did not come back to Abraham. No, he said, I can't go back to the mountain. I won't go back to Abraham because compared to Abraham, I'm a garnish, right? We said he's like Robin to Batman. I don't want to wear that dumb costume as Robin. It's always Gamla Lot. It's always also Lot who's with Abraham. I want to be my own guy. So God rescues Lot. His two daughters seduce him because they believe the world's come to an end. They have children, Moab and Ammon. And they are cast away from the Jewish people. So as Ruth is coming back in our story, there's apparently a bat kol, a heavenly voice that proclaims, I didn't hear it myself, but apparently they say so, that as she is coming back, God says she's the first to come back from Lot, meaning she's coming back to Abraham, to us, to the Jewish people, bringing what was lost full circle back. So it's a very profound idea. So now we understand context. We understand the importance of this book. Let's get into the book itself. So what I want to do with these classes is not only try to bring out thematic elements that I hope will be meaningful to all of us, for discussion purposes and otherwise, but also just to see the text, because I believe that these four chapters, it's very dense, very layered, very nuanced by design. It's almost like Shmuel Samuel wrote a very long manuscript, you know, that may have been 20, 25 chapters, and then he had an editor, right? Probably Mrs. Samuel, right? I'm just teasing. Got together, the editor said, you know, you got to compact this. It's never going to be a bestseller, you know? People have very short attention spans. You know, they want it in a PDF document. They want it four chapters, 85 verses. So it went from 850 verses, and it became more and more dense and compact. It rivals, in some ways, the actual Torah, the Chumash, which has a pretty good author, too, right? God. I mean, you know, every word, every little extra letter and how it's read versus how it's written, there's a lot there, and I think you'll experience it beginning tonight. So on page 84 in your text, let's begin Ruth, Megillat Ruth, from the beginning. Vayehi, and it was, Bimei, in the days, Shafot HaShoftim, when the judges judged. Vayehi Ra'av Aretz, that there was a famine in the land of Israel. I added that word. Vayelech Ish, and a certain man went, mi Beis Lechem Yehuda, from Bethlehem of Judah, Lagur, to dwell temporarily, Biste Moab, in the fields of the Moabites, who he went, this individual, this Ish, Ishto, and his wife, Ushne Vanav, and his two sons. Stop. This is an amazing verse, because it tells us absolutely nothing. If you look up the word non sequitur in a dictionary, this is right there. Okay, so ultimate example. It gives us, well, let's just examine it. Okay, first of all, Vayehi. Vayehi, and it was, is a really bad way to open something. Because we know, the rabbis say, whenever it says Vayehi, it's a nice way of saying Oive. Literally. Not going to be good things happening. The most famous is Vayehi Bimei Achashverosh. Right? The story of Purim begins, and it was in the days of Achashverosh, and then, you know, two chapters later, the guy with the triangle hats threatening a Holocaust against the Jews. In this case, Vayehi is giving us a little bit of a foreshadowing of things that are coming that are not so wonderful, a little unholy. So it's not going to be good. So it was in the days when the judges judged. Okay, but there's a problem here. The judges began judging somewhere in the year 2500. And they stopped judging somewhere almost in the year 2900. So you're talking four centuries. Thank you for narrowing it down, Shmuel HaNavi. Gee, you brought it down to 400 years. Thank you very, very much. So it's not exactly telling us anything meaningful in a chronological sense. It was when the judges judged, nicely. Somewhere in the book of Judges, you'll find this story embedded there. Great. Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful. And by the way, judges judge. Gee, that's something novel. What else are judges supposed to do? Okay, I won't say this because I know we're living in Luzerne County. I see smiles already. Judges, you know, we won't talk about judges in Luzerne County in lieu of, I wasn't here for the history. I know it's a little bit sordid with the judges and the kids and the whole thing. We won't go there, okay? But what are judges supposed to do except judge? So the rabbis have a whole lot to say about this because this Lashon Kaful, this double language, seems to be a little superfluous. Shvot HaShoftim, when the judges judge. So one opinion is God was judging the judges. God was not happy with the leadership supplied by the judges at that time. That's one possibility. Another is what we said at the outset in our preface. Shefot HaShoftim. It was when people judged the judges. They would, in their own mind, decide whether somebody was worthy of the mantle as a shofet, as a judge, somebody to follow their Jewish law or not. Now, you have to understand that this is not acceptable on any level. If you have a judge, a shofet, who is accepted by the majority of the people, for all intents and purposes, for better or worse, this is who you have, you know? And the people were very chutzpahdik. The Talmud says, like, the judge would sort of say to the person, you know, you got a little bit of a sliver there between your teeth, a nice way of saying that you got your problems, you got your sins. Really? And the guy would respond, the plaintiff would turn to the judge and yell at him in court, really? Well, why don't you get the beam out of your eye there? Meaning you got a lot worse. You're much more involved in chicanery and bribery or whatever. I'm not going to listen to you. So there was a chutzpah, an audacity on behalf of the people who decided it was their license to decide the appropriateness of the leadership. So that's not a good thing. So the judges judge, and there was a famine in the land of Israel. Not a good thing. And it says twice the word Vayehi. Do you notice that? Vayehi b'yemei Shevet HaShoftim. And it was in the days of the judges, and there was a Rav Ha'aretz. Why the Vayehi? You didn't have to say the second Vayehi. So some say that it was a double famine. There was a famine both in a real sense, food, lechem, but there was also a famine, a dearth of Torah, leadership. So it's a double, because lechem, the bread, the sustenance, can also be a metaphor for Torah. So there wasn't leadership, there wasn't Torah being taught or learned there in Israel. So it was a double famine. Vayelech ish, a man went. Now this is ridiculous. Why not just say who he was? I mean, the next verse is actually going to say, oh, by the way, you want to know who the characters are? Let's tell you the cast of characters. So then why do we need this whole verse, which really tells us very little, doesn't tell us anything. There was a man. Well, the word ish means he had gravitas. He was a chashev guy, an important guy. Okay, great. So he's a chashev guy. He went from Bethlehem in Judah, and he went lagur to dwell in the land, the fields of Moab. Now, lagur is a famous verse that you remember from your Haggadah, right? Remember? Lagur ba'aretz. We only came, as they said to Pharaoh, the sons of Jacob, to dwell temporarily, a couple hundred years, in the land of Egypt, right? So it usually means a ger, a stranger. We're not gonna put down roots here. So ostensibly, when this man left Israel because of the famine, he, his wife, and his two sons, he did so with the intent, lagur, to dwell temporarily in the fields of Moab. Now I have to tell you that Moab at that time was the ultimate enemy of the Jewish people, not just in terms of what we discussed in our preamble, that they are the anti-Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, anti-Sarah, anti-chesed, anti-kindness type of nation, but they were always at war with us. And in fact, if you know the story of the famous Ehud and Eglon, the king of Moab, there's a famous, you know, they were always at loggerheads with these people, and they were adjacent, parallel to Israel. So for this man to leave Israel and go to the mortal enemy of the Jewish people was really not a good thing, right? It's like one of the, you know, Billy Hatfield running to seek sanctuary with the McCoys. Not a good thing in the eyes of God. So this man went from Bethlehem, Judah, ostensibly just to dwell temporarily while the famine was raging in the land of Israel. He went to the fields of Moab. He went with his wife and his two sons. So now we're going to get on to cast the characters. You ready? Verse 2, Pasuk Beis. V'shem ha'ish, oh, by the way, that man was a man named Elimelech. V'shem ishto, and the name of his wife was Naomi. V'shem shnei vanav, and the name of his two sons was Mahlon v'chilyon. Was Mahlon and then Kilyon. Ephratim, they were Ephratim, which loosely translated would be like, they were nobility, they were aristocrats, they were chashev people, because they clearly weren't from Ephraim, they weren't Benjaminites. Mi Beit Lechem Yehuda came from Bethlehem in Judah. Vayavos de Moav, they came to Moab's fields, Vayusham. And there they remained. They became invested in the fields of Moab. So let's take a step back now. So now we know the cast of characters. We know that it was Elimelech, his wife Naomi, their two sons, Mahlon and Kilion. Now we're going to have a lot of playful little parts of our Megillah. This is one of them. We have a lot of euphemisms that come up in our text. Remember how we pointed out that in order, according to Rashi, to set the chronology of the time period, he said that actually Boaz is only mentioned here as a Boaz. But if in the book of Judges, he's called Ibtsan, right? He had a little pen name. So I believe that a lot of these people have pen names, as we're going to see in a moment. For example, Elimelech used to walk around saying to everybody, gives you a little hint into his demeanor, to his arrogance. He said, Eli HaMelech. Ah, the king's going to come from me. I am a purebred because I have genealogy all the way back to that guy who jumped into the Red Sea, Nachshon, son of Aminadab, the head of the tribe of Judah. He's my great-great-great-grandfather. Say, Eli Melech. He used to tell people, he used to pat himself on the chest and proudly proclaim, the kingship will come from me, because I guess people at that point must have been sensitive to the need for real leadership. That king of Israel would be something on the horizon. So he used to brag to people. And ironically, he's not wrong. Because if Eli Melech has two sons, now they die, yes. But the widow of one of his sons, Ruth, marries Boaz, where the kings come from. But that was a form of what's called levirate marriage, yibum. And that child, Oved, who is going to be born at the end of the text, actually belongs to Elimelech's dead son. So in a very bizarre, twisted way, he was right. He just wasn't quite right in the way he hoped and envisioned, right? God said, you think it's going to be you, really, Elimelech? Well, people are not going to look at you in such a positive note, as we'll see in a moment. But long term, okay, Elimelech's a good name for you, because ultimately it won't be your vision for how you're going to be the great-grandfather of the kings, but in a very strange way, it will actually come to fruition. So Elimelech, by the rabbi's accounts, was the richest man in Israel. He was the Parnes Hador. He was the one who, by himself, could have supported the entire generation, even with the famine. He had millions of dollars, property, apple stocks. I mean, he had the best, okay? He could have easily taken care of everyone. The fact that he was sensitive to the needs of the people and saw the knocks on the door were coming. The poor were coming because there was a famine. Who better to go to than Elimelech? Please, can you help? So I guess in the first couple of months of the famine, he did okay. And then he started seeing, you know, the potential for the devastation of his bank account. Even though, you're really by Torah law, you're only supposed to give up to 20%. So he'd still leave him with, you know, a couple million bucks. He'd be okay. He wouldn't be in the poorhouse. But he was resentful to the point where he said, I'm not staying. I'm not going to do this. I will not see my own resources expended upon the people. So he picked up his family, ostensibly against their will. It's all about him, not about Naomi, not about the two sons. And they leave. Now, can you imagine that the singular shining light, Elimelech, the man is walking around bragging about being the king, being the leader of the people, the representative of the people, the man who can write a check and take care of everybody during this dire situation. He betrays the people, the land of Israel, in the most profound way possible. Not only does he cut out in the middle of the night, this is sort of, I remember I was in Yeshiva in Baltimore, I'm going to use a sports analogy for you, when the evil Robert Irsay takes the Baltimore Colts at 1 a.m. out of their compound about 2 miles away from my yeshiva, takes the Colts and runs them out to Indianapolis in the middle of the night. And this is just a football team, okay? The people in Baltimore were, just go back and Google the history, okay? They were outraged. I mean, this is the Colts, Johnny Unitas. This is their identity. And he did it in a way. He didn't come up and say, hey, I'm just moving to Indianapolis. I got a better deal. Nice gig, nice new stadium. Bye. He did it middle of the night. The trucks pull up at the compound. Bye, see ya, right? Gone. So the betrayal of Elimelech to do the same thing, pick up his family in the middle of the night and take his bank account and move it to the Cayman Islands. Everything's offshore now. And then, boom, he goes to Moab. But he didn't just go to Moab by chance. Why do you think he chose Moab? Because the Moabites were the stingiest people in the world. And if they would see him, they'd say, well, what are you doing? You're a Jew. You hate us. He would say, but I'm with you guys. I don't want to take my wealth and give it to everyone as a chesed, as a kindness. I'm with you guys. I'm an honorary Moabite. I will proudly be a schnorr and not give anybody money. And they would go, yay, yay, come on, come to Chaim. Come on, be one of the guys, right? They give Moabite badges. And he's welcome because he's a schnorr like them, right? He's anti-giving kindness, tzedakah. So what better place to hide out to seek a sanctuary during the time of the famine than Moab, right? Because it's against their principle. They're Sodomites, essentially, so they don't want to share. He's welcome. Come to Ron. Come on. Join us, right? So his intent was what? We said lagur, to dwell. But verse 2 closes with the words, Vayushan. He became existentially a part of Moabite culture. So much so, they welcome him. He serves, apparently helps them militarily. His sons end up marrying princesses from Moab after his death. That's where we have Ruth and Orpah, the story. So he really betrayed Israel in the most profound way possible. And you don't do that to our beloved Israel. I'll say it a little louder. We don't betray our beloved Israel or bad things are going to happen. Okay. Just making sure you can read that any way you want. Okay. So Naomi comes with him. His wife and his two sons, Mahlon and Kilion. Now, I have to have a little humor here. Mahlon and Kilion could not be their real names. You don't have, even in Israel, where they love to take like very, very strange names and name the boys and girls, they don't want to use like, you know, cookie cutter generic names. So, there are Abrahams and Isaacs and Jacobs and Sarahs and Rebeccas, you know, et al. But you have a lot of like Devere and Dror and, you know, nice names that maybe appear once or twice somewhere in the 24 books of the Torah. But you don't see a Mahlon and Kilion. Why? Well, I'll explain it to you. The word Mahlon means disease. A machala is a disease. And the word Kilion means death, kila, to be destroyed. So meet my beautiful, I can imagine getting up, you know, at the circumcisions. Okay, Dad, Elimelech, Rabbi Elimelech, why did you name your sons Mahlon and Kilion? Well, they're death, disease, and destruction and death. Yay, let's celebrate L'chaim, right? So clearly, the Torah is naming them disease and death, because that's, in a sense, what happens to them. They bring about their own destruction of their names, and their genetics are gone forever. However, interestingly, the name Mahlon, which means machala, disease, also has a second meaning, a duality to its purpose. Mechila, forgiveness. Thank you. Forgiveness. Because ultimately, Kilion, his brother, gone, never, nothing. But Mahlon's widow was Ruth. So if ever marriage comes through Ruth, that child belongs to Mahlon in death, and therefore he lived again. So somehow God forgave him. So yes, he was diseased, but a diseased person can make a comeback. A dead person doesn't make a comeback. Well, we don't think they make comebacks, okay? There's no comebacks at that point. Whereas a diseased person, there's possibilities for refuah, right? And that's exactly what happened. His soul had a refuah, was healed, was reclaimed. So that's a kind of a neat idea. Okay, so you have these kids, Mahlon and Kilion, you have the wife Naomi, but clearly it's all about Elimelech. He made the decision, his wife went along for the ride. It's very clear that Naomi really didn't want to leave. But he made the decision making part of the family. So he says, we're going. What's she supposed to do? She's in a very, very difficult position, so she comes with him. Okay? Now we're in Pasuk Gimel. Remember we said Vayihi? Bad things are on the way. Well, not only was there a famine, but in Pasuk Gimel, Vayomas Elimelech Ish Naomi, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, dies. Vatisha'er he, she's left bereaved, alone, Ushnei Banaha, along with her two sons. Now, why does it say, all of a sudden, Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi, dies? So from here, the rabbis say something very profound. That a spouse, God forbid, who dies, That death is felt much more profoundly on the surviving widow or widower than anyone else in the world. It's not a judgment, it's just the way it is. That the couple, you know, bonds, the man is and the wife get together, that union as Adam and Eve, right? That it's not good for a man to be alone. And when that death happens, it's profoundly felt by Naomi the widow, more than anyone else, even her own sons who love their father, obviously. Okay? So that's the idea behind that. It's a very profound idea. He died, but the rabbis are going to explain to us, he didn't die right away. First, God decides to give him a little message. He starts to wipe away his bank account. So he brought with him tons of animals and, you know, valuables. All of a sudden, there's a fire, and the animals die, and there's disease. Get the message, Elimelech, return. No, nothing. So after striking out against the possessions, kind of like Saras in this week's Parsha with the leprosy, right? First it strikes the person's home, then it strikes the person's clothes, getting a little close to home, and then if the person doesn't get the message to repent, to do teshuvah, then it hits the person's skin, right? Same thing here. First God wanted to get Elimelech to wake up, smell the Nescafe, and come back home where he belonged. No. Valuables, gone. So they are poor beyond belief, and then they lose their father. Elimelech. Now, do they change? Did they go back home? No. Let's look at the next verse, the next pasuk. Vayusu lahem. And so, after the death of their father, the two young men, Mahlon and Kilion, they get married. And they marry Nashim Moavios, Moabite women. Shem Achas Orpah. The first one is called Orpah. The Shem Hashenis, Rus. And the name of the second one is Ruth. Arruth. Vayesh Visham Ke Eser Shanim. And they dwell there in the fields of Moab for about 10 years. Now, I should mention something. There is one other time that we know of in the 24 books of the Torah where it uses a very strange language. It says there was a man who went from a certain house and he married a certain woman and they had a child and it doesn't use any names. And this is the only other time where at the outset, remember we said there was a certain man from Bethlehem in Judah, and he had a wife, and he had two sons. Remember, we didn't know who they were. Then they tell us in verse 2. Can you guess where that first time is? It's Book of Names, Book of Shmos in Exodus. Vayelech ish mi beis Levi. Thank you, doctor. And a man, a certain man from the house of Levi, went, married a woman from Levi, and they had a man named Moses. Oh my gosh. Right? Moses. So the first redeemer of the Jewish people, the Goel, was Moses, of course, redeemed us from the Exodus of Egypt. This story opens, and Shmuel, Samuel, is clearly plagiarizing, with permission, I went, by the way, license from God. He's plagiarizing the words that God chose in the book of Exodus. He's saying that this is the creation of who? David HaMelech, and ultimately the Mashiach, the final redeemer for our people. So both stories of redemption begin exactly that same way, with that sort of non sequitur beginning, Exodus, Moses, and then this is the story ultimately that will lead to the Mashiach, to the Messiah. So they both began the same way. I needed to just to contextualize that. Okay, let's go back inside. So they married in verse Dalet, in verse 4, they get married to Moabite ladies, one named Orpah, one named Ruth. Now, the fact that it says Orpah's name first seems to implication, the mashmaut is that maybe Orpah at that time was more special somehow than Ruth. They were both princesses, and they were either children, grandchildren, it's not so clear, of the infamous King Eglon. If you don't know who King Eglon was, let me tell you a little bit about him. King Eglon was this 475-pound schlub of a king, who was the king of Moab, big, fat, obese guy. He was killed by the great hero, Ehud, who snuck a sword in, right, and came in. But as he came into Eglon, Eglon sees Ehud, he's all alone. He says, well, why are you here? I got a message from God. So Eglon, and this was not a small feat, when he heard the name of God, picked his blubber up off his throne in honor of God's name. God stopped and said, okay, Eglon, you're a schlub. You're a fat idiot, and you're going to be killed in about 25 seconds. But you got up out of respect for me. I will get up off of my throne, and I will allow one of your progeny to sit on my throne. That's going to be King David, King Solomon, and the Messiah. I mean, amazing, right? One act by this wicked guy, the big, fat, schlubby king of Moab, and God says, I'm going to get up off my throne and allow your children to inherit my throne. It's stunning, right? It's amazing. That's King Eglon. Now, why is this germane? Because Ruth and Orpah are, according to some accounts, sisters, but at the very minimum, they're both descendants of this big, fat, schlubby King Eglon, king of Moab. They are princesses. So not only did Machlon and Kilion marry Moabite ladies, they marry the Moabite ladies, the princesses. Gorgeous, beautiful women who had yichas, a genealogy, at least in Moabite terms. Now, it became a problem for them, because how do you leave them? In other words, once you marry the princess, it's not exactly politically correct to say, okay, I got to go back to Israel now. So it really put a situation for them where that was untenable, because they couldn't go back to Israel with Moabite wives, because they hadn't, according to most people, converted them. They were still Moabites. So you can't bring them back, because remember, no Moabites are welcome. So you can't bring them back to Judah, or you'd be like shunned and cast away. You can't exactly divorce them, or the Moabites are going to say, what, our girls aren't good enough for you? And they probably would face, you know, kind of what's going on in the Middle East right now. Not happy ending for them in the land, the fields of Moab, because you don't divorce the princesses. So they were kind of stuck there for 10 years. Now, in that course of 10 years, Naomi at least has her sons. And then what happened? Verse 5, and we'll end here tonight. Vayamusu gam shnehem Machlon v'Chilion. Also, they died, Machlon and Kilion, Mr. Disease and Mr. Death. Vatisha'er ha'isha mishnei yeladeh misha. And she, Naomi the lady, the woman, this magnificent lady, was left alone from her two sons and from her husband. But they're no longer called Banaha, as they were in the previous verse. They're called Yiladeh. Because the word Banaha, which means a son, like a ben, has the word binyan. You could build. I could have a future built from them. But once they marry the Moabites and they're now dead, there's no future for them. So they're just children. They're Yiladim, because there's no potential for progeny anymore at that point. So poor Naomi has lost everything. She's lost her husband, her sons. Her life is gone. But fear not, because next week we are going to have the most magnificent story that you're ever going to hear. They say that what will transpire on the journey that Naomi takes with Ruth and with Orpah back to Israel, to that little lonely journey, and we're only privy to this because of Samuel wrote this book,
is one of the most magnificent points, because it literally is going to tell us what it means to be Jewish, how you define your Judaism from without to within, and ultimately produce King David, King Solomon, the Mashiach, all from this amazing little dialogue and this amazing little journey. Just to leave one last thought for you. Ruth and Orpah. Ruth's going to go back home. Orpah will not go back home. Now, Orpah's name is not her real name, because the Oref is the back of your neck. And she's called Orpah because she turned her back and leaves Naomi, whereas Ruth, famously, Dafka, clings to her and says, no, where you go, I go, the famous, famous poetic verses that we'll have next year, next week, not next year, in part two of our class. But just to give you a little, just to show you how amazing this book is, okay? Orpah rejects Naomi and Ruth in a very profound way. And the night that she leaves, she is going to have relations with a whole tribe of military guys from the Philistines, like hundreds of officers. And she's like prostitutes herself in the most egregious way possible, like to turn around and to do everything against Naomi and Ruth's purity, just to undo it all in a horrible way. That's why she's called Orpah, because she turned her back against Judaism, against God, against everything holy. Of course, we know that ultimately Ruth and Boaz are going to produce David HaMelech. Can you guess that Orpah and Ruth are going to meet another day on a battlefield? Because Orpah, from one of the unions, we don't know which one, creates Goliath. Goliath meets David. And when Goliath meets David on the battlefield, you have Ruth and Orpah, their grandparents, meeting back again. Everyone, I wish you a wonderful, wonderful week. Come back next week, please.